Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM's show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we've got some breaking news. Breaking news. Maybe not super breaking news because the unfortunate thing about our recording / release schedule is that we generally record on Monday nights and release on Friday mornings, which means there's a good Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday in the middle where things can happen and inevitably do.
I'm just going to blame a subspace anomaly.
Okay.
It just took longer for this message to get to everybody.
Yeah, I guess so. So we're going to be talking about the thing that everyone else was talking about last week, which is the shakeup in the Star Trek Discovery writer's room, I guess. Brian Fuller is leaving in his role as a showrunner, and he's handing off his duties to his, as he described them, co-showrunners, Gretchen Berg and Aaron Harberts, who will now be taking over the reins of the writing staff and the show on the whole, presumably. And that doesn't mean that Fuller is gone. He is still going to be an executive producer. He has still written, apparently, the first two episodes, although I don't know exactly what that means, because at one point he said that, like, okay, they say 13 episodes, but is that 13 hours or 13 episodes? Because they've also said that the first episode is going to be 2 hours. And, you know, Fuller said that he and Kurtzman wrote the first hour and that Meyer wrote the second hour, which makes me think that maybe it's just they're doing, like, let's show two episodes at once on the first night.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that they've got something that's sort of like the type of episode that they do now where they can break it in half so that when they, I don't know, I guess when they go, but the thing is, this isn't going on television.
Well, it might someday. The
first one's going to go on, but like when it's on the app or something, I don't know, maybe, no.
I mean,
doesn't make sense.
No, but I mean, you see that, like even on like I've been watching Mad Men. And like there's the season 5 and season 6 premieres are both 2 hours long.
Yeah.
And you can tell that they're definitely a two-parter. But at the same time, like there is a definitive break in the middle where you can be like, that's the end of part one and this is the start of part two. Like, it's like really freaking obvious. Like more obvious than it was in the Star Trek two-parters, to be honest. So I have a feeling that it's a situation like that, you know? They want to, I mean, who knows? It probably is like a quote-unquote two-parter, but I think it is two distinct episodes. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, that's probably right. You know, I mean, like, because if he's delineating, like, who wrote what, that really feels like they work together, but then it was, you know, he and Kurtzman, they wrote definitely, they were working together and Meyer was working together, and then they said, this is where we're starting, and he said, this is where it'll end, and they went to their corners and made it work out.
Yeah. So whether or not, I mean, who knows, maybe he will be credited, you know, with the screenplay for that second hour, or maybe he wrote hour number three, you know, but whatever it is, he's written, you know, a couple episodes and they are still using his outline for the entire first season. So it's not like they're throwing, you know, Fuller off and all of his work or whatever. I mean, it's still very much his idea. It's just someone else is coming in to execute it. And they're not coming in.
Yeah.
They've been there the whole time. You know, that's the other
right
thing. I mean, Berg and Harberts were executive producers on the show way before any of this happened, you know?
Right. And you know, and to speak to your point, like, I really have a feeling that it's the delay that has caused this. I think if they had hit production when they were supposed to, like Fuller's got a really big schedule in front of, like he's got a whole lot going on, and it's just one of those things where as soon as it shifts out of a certain time frame, he has to say, you know, well, I've got other obligations that I've got to take care of too. so here's everything I've done, and I'll call you guys, but you know, you're on your own.
Yeah, you know, he's finishing up American Gods. Apparently, he's still starting his Amazing Stories relaunch, which I thought was dead. You know, I had heard about that a while back, and I'm like, oh, well, I guess that's not happening anymore. But apparently it still is, which is awesome, I personally think.
Oh, I think it's awesome, too. I think if there's anybody that should be remaking Amazing Stories, it's Brian Fuller. I think he's got the type of spark to bring a show like that back.
And I hope he really does what they did on the original Amazing Stories, where they brought in these, you know, like auteur filmmakers to come in and do half-hour episodes. Because that original show had people like, I mean, didn't Scorsese do an episode? You know, Spielberg, obviously, Zemeckis. Zemeckis did an episode which is like, it's called Head of the Class.
Yeah.
You can really see that it was like a template for Back to the Future. And Irvin Kershner even did an episode called Hell to Pay, which is awesome, about a killer toupee. Glad to see it's coming back. Sad that Fuller is leaving, though, in terms of the disco department. But, you know, he's handing it off to a couple people who are very talented in their own right, and they are, you know, proteges of Fuller in a sense. Berg and Harberts worked on two prior Fuller shows, Wonder Falls and Pushing Daisies. And they've worked on a bunch of other stuff as well. They got their start doing Beverly Hills 90210 back in the day, and later went on to work on Roswell, where they wrote a substantial number of episodes when Ron Moore was on that show. And that's a really good show. I don't know if you've seen it. I don't know if anyone else has seen it.
I've seen the first few episodes of Roswell, and for what it is, it's good.
I know
that's like, you know, sort of like a backhanded, that seems like a backhanded compliment, but it's very much a 90s show from like a non-major network. Like, you know, you're going in, you're not expecting, you don't get like an NBC, you know, LA Law crime drama sort of thing. You're like, oh, well, okay, this is a teen focused show from, you know, a side network.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. It is very good. I don't know. Like I have a personal fondness for that show because it was the show that my now wife and I would watch when we were first starting to hang out, but whatever. It's a good show. You know, and a lot of Star Trek people, you got Ron Moore, their you know, director was Jonathan Frakes and stuff, so it was pretty cool. So, they've also written a movie called Valentine, which is a
starring
movie.
David Boreanaz, correct?
Yeah. I saw that movie, like, before it came out, and I have very little recollection of it. I remember not liking it, but I feel the need to watch it again now.
If I'm thinking of the correct movie, and it's entirely possible that I'm not, if it's the one I'm thinking of, I saw a scene where somebody got like locked in a steam room.
Could be.
I think that's this movie.
I don't know. I think I remember Katherine Heigl being in the first scene.
She is.
She's like a coroner or something like that. And then like, I don't know, whatever. Obviously it left a huge impression on us. But we need to check it out again for sure.
Yeah.
They created their own show called Pepper Dennis, which is not readily available, unfortunately, but it starred Rebecca Romijn as a Chicago news reporter. Looks pretty cool. And then they also were apparently co-showrunners on this show called Mercy, which, I mean, don't get me started on this freaking showrunner thing. Any other job, any other, you know, field in this industry, it's very clear who does what because there's a million credits for a million things. But when it comes to the absolute most important credit in television, it doesn't exist. You know, people are just like executive producers, and it's like, well, okay, there's 15 executive producers on this show, and that guy, it is an executive producer because, you know, someone else gave him money to do something and he's a silent partner and he's never even heard of this show. And then this guy over here created it and wrote and directed every single episode, and he stars in it too, and it's like that they get the same credit, you know. Please, industry.
And a fantastic example, if anybody's looking for one, is Westworld. that's like Jonathan Nolan's show, but he gets J.J. Abrams' name put on it, and HBO sits down at the table and says, okay, tell me what you got. And probably, you know, it's like Abrams walks in and he's like, hey, guys, how you doing? Here's a show. And he's going to tell you all about it. See ya. I'm going to go work on another multi-million-dollar movie.
Yeah, yeah. It's like J.J. Abrams and Jonathan Nolan. Meanwhile, poor Lisa Joy.
Right. Who has like credits all over the thing.
Yeah. Right. Because she and Nolan, you know, they do the show together. And they're married, by the way.
I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
That's such a good show. Oh my God. Anyway.
I'm only three episodes in as of the recording of this, but yes, I agree with you. It's an amazing show. The scene that freaked me out was seeing the computer regressed Anthony Hopkins. Like, that technology's gotten too good, man.
Yeah, it has.
Way
it has.
Too good.
Yeah. Did you see they just released on iTunes the first set of like piano roll covers of pop songs?
No. Yeah. No, I didn't see that. Oh, I'm going to have to check that out.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, so yes, what this all means, all I'm trying to say here is it's really freaking hard to tell who is the showrunner on what show, you know? And because of that, I think they were showrunners on just two shows, Pepper Dennis and GCB, but I could be completely wrong about that. You know, they were credited as co-showrunners on Mercy, but I'm assuming that doesn't mean they show ran it together. I'm assuming that's like co-producer, where it's, you know, who knows?
Well, yeah,
because it's a made-up credit.
Then, the show Revenge, which was an ABC show, there's the credit for 28 episodes as executive producer, but then consulting producer for 7 episodes.
Right. And that's one of those things where like consulting producers are brought on, but they're like, that's like outside of the normal like hierarchy. But then like, I think like, I don't remember if this is how it was with Enterprise, but I can imagine a scenario where like in season 3, Manny Cota was brought on as a consulting producer. And then after he, you know, knocked it out of the park, then they made him the executive producer in season 4, you know?
Right. You bring somebody in to sort of like learn the ropes, and then you're like, okay, you run it. I'm tired of everybody blaming me for things.
But it's like not someone who's like just starting. It's like someone who has had a career. Like, for example, on Disco, Nicholas Meyer is a consulting producer, you know?
Right.
So like he's a very well-established, obviously they have a press release announcing that he's going to be working on the show, but he hasn't had that type of television experience, you know?
Right.
He's just written, you know, like 15 movies and 13 books or something like that, you know? So that's yeah, what they were doing on what was it, Revenge, and then they became executive producers for like a couple seasons, right?
Yeah, 2 years, 2013 to 2014.
Yeah, and most recently they worked on the show Rain, which apparently is still going on. I guess there is some people were thinking it was canceled, but now it looks like it's coming back. I don't know.
About a very pleasant person known as Mary, Queen of Scots. If you're not familiar with her, she was a laugh riot, man. It's just life of the party.
But the one show where they seem to be the showrunners for sure is the show GCB, which was produced or executive produced by Darren Star, the guy who did what's it called, Sex and the City, right?
Yeah.
And it was about a woman from Dallas who like left and moved to LA and started a family, and then her husband basically created like this Ponzi scheme and robbed a bunch of people and then ran off with his girlfriend, and then they got into a car accident. So now his wife, you know, the main character played by Leslie Bibb, needs to move back to Dallas with her kids. You know, she moves in with her extremely rich mom, played by Annie Potts. And the problem where all the drama and humor comes in, because it is more of a comedy than a drama, is that she was basically the queen bee at the school in high school. She was definitely the Rachel McAdams character in that high school. And all of the people who she was mean to are there now in you know, rather high up positions in society, and now she's going to get what's coming to her, in a sense. You know what I mean?
Oh, I know what you mean.
And yeah. And hijinks ensue. And yeah, you know, the show only lasted 10 episodes, but I watched the first three so far, and I'm enjoying it. I mean, it's not revolutionary by any stretch of the imagination. You can tell that they were definitely going after a Desperate Housewives sort of vibe, but it's amusing. The acting is good. I find it to be charming.
Okay. Well, when I check it out, I will tell you whether I agree or not.
And if you do want to check it out, it's on Hulu. So head on over there and check it out. So yeah, so that's Berg and Harberts, and they're the people who are going to be in charge of this here show, and we'll definitely be getting into more of their work as we get closer to May.
Now, before we get into this next name, please tell me we don't have to get into everything that he's done.
Maybe please. Not everything, but I can't wait to get into a lot of it. Probably a lot of it, which you're dreading getting into.
Oh yeah, I'd say that's a fair... fair comment. Not tearing the guy down, because he has done some very good things, and those things I'd like to rewatch. But
well, here's the thing about him: he's made a ton of movies, and a lot of them are very, very good, and a lot of them are not so good. And that's just the way it works when you have a career which spans decades. You know?
You can't please everybody.
No.
No.
Akiva Goldsman.
Yes.
Is being brought on as. What I'm assuming is, you know, a consulting, producing type of role. It sounds like he's coming on to help Berg and Harberts, you know, because he's someone with experience who can kind of make sure that things stay on track and give them the support that they need in order to get this thing up and running and where it's supposed to be. So Akiva Goldsman is a name which a lot of people know. Yeah. It was one of the first names that I knew in terms of screenwriters back when I was, you know.
He was, I suppose it would be fair to say he's part of the Esther House generation, at least, the 90s, one of the writers that we knew. There is a certain type of nerdy fan where we all know his name because of certain things that he's worked on. Let's just pull the Band-Aid off. Batman and Robin is probably his most infamous work. He has had, you're absolutely right, he has had an amazing career. He has done some fantastic things.
He's won an Oscar.
And he will never, ever, ever be able to walk away from Batman and Robin within sort of the nerd community. Nobody, just like Joel Schumacher, who directed it, those two names, that is the work that will, for good or ill, be the first thing that pops to a bunch of people's minds when it comes to him, despite the Oscar, despite working on Cinderella Man, and despite working on A Beautiful Mind, and despite working on a whole bunch of hit. I mean, he's had a lot of hit movies.
Oh yeah.
A lot.
He's a big name in the industry for sure. You know, and he's someone who you can count on to deliver a product, which is definitely very popular. You know, I mean, whether it's well received by critics or not, and you know, lots of times it is, lots of times it's not, but it's always a fan favorite, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe not with certain types of fans, but I mean, Batman Forever, for example, which is one of his very first movies.
Mm-hmm.
That the reason why they brought him back to write Batman and Robin, and the reason why they spent like $557 million on Batman and Robin, was because Batman Forever was a huge success. You know,
Batman Forever made more money than Batman Returns, and they regarded it as, you know, therefore a template to follow. As I understand it, Goldsman came in. They already had a script that was darker, and then Goldsman came in and, for lack of a term that I would use elsewise, he Schumachered it up. Okay? And you got a... Like, if you watch Batman Forever, it is a movie very obviously of two minds. There's very much a pull toward the dark that Tim Burton had embraced, and then there's very much a pull toward what we later got with Batman and Robin. And for many years, seeing his whole body of work, there are plenty of other things that he's written that I don't like. But what Batman and Robin has come to be, and Batman Forever, what they've both come to be a real shining example of is that the writer's job, when it comes down to it sometimes, is to deliver what the director wants, what the director's vision is.
It's not even necessary. It's not even necessarily what the director wants. It's what the studio wants. Well, but I mean, but just to go back, you know, yeah. The way that you describe Batman Forever, I guess you could say Batman Forever is the Two-Face of Batman movies.
I hate that you use it that way, but sure. Sure.
No,
absolutely.
I mean, like, because it was Joel Schumacher who originally wanted Batman Forever to be darker. And apparently there is a cut of Batman Forever out there, which is much darker. And he's been trying desperately to get it out to the public, and the studio essentially won't let him.
No, the way I've heard the story is that he wanted to make Batman and Robin darker.
No, no.
But the studio said, no, you can't do that. It was the light, zany stuff that made people happy, so you're going to do that for the next movie.
That came later. Yeah. But first, he wanted Batman Forever not to be super dark, but to be darker. Certainly have darker elements. There is a whole bunch of stuff at the beginning in Arkham Asylum with René Auberjonois and stuff like that. True. And it was such a substantial re-edit that when it came time for them to release like the big box set, he's like, I want to do a director's cut. Will you let me do it? And the studio said, that's fine, so long as it's not reordering things and everything and making it so completely different from the original version that we can't do a seamless branching version on the DVD in order to include the original theatrical cut as well.
Well, that's a rip.
And basically, he said, well, that's not because we completely re-edited this movie. There's no way to do that. It has to be its own separate thing. And they're like, Okay, no,
so here's a question then. Like, okay, Goldsman as a writer, any writer then, right? They write the screenplay. I mean, you could almost make the argument then that Batman Forever or even Batman, I mean, to an extent, Batman and Robin, you know, everybody deserves blame for that one. But I mean, you know, Schwarzenegger brought his own, you know, script doctor on to write his lines and stuff like that. I mean, you know, in that light, you almost feel bad for Goldsman because, like you said, Batman Forever is his third movie. Batman and Robin is his fifth. He did A Time to Kill with Schumacher in between those.
And The Client was his first one. Because for a while there, it was Schumacher's like, I'm going to do a Grisham movie and then a Batman movie and then a Grisham movie and then a Batman movie. You know, I mean, he did that like for 2 years in a row or whatever it was. And Goldsman wrote both. You know, both the Grisham and the Batman. And, like, The Client and A Time to Kill are both really, really good.
Yeah, A Time to Kill is good. I do, yes. I remember seeing that in the theater.
I remember
enjoying it greatly.
I remember seeing the trailer for that in the theater 50,000 times that summer. And being so glad when the movie came out just so that I wouldn't have to see it anymore. Because it always ended with that great line, Sam Jackson, where he's like, yes, they deserve to die, and I hope they burn in hell.
Oh, yes, I remember that. I remember that. Okay, so so let's do like a compare-contrast sort of thing, right? He's a writer on these movies, and it seems to be that the example is that on television, he's going to be able to exert more influence being a producer-writer than, you know, he got in the movies, or at least, you know, in the early part of the movies that he was working on. So would it be fair, more fair then, and you'll notice I'm trying to wriggle out of going back and revisiting his movies, wouldn't it be more fair to just go back and look at the TV that he's worked on, because that's going to be more reflective of his creative impulse, his desire to do things?
I definitely think it would be a more representative sample of his work in terms of like what he's going to be doing on Disco, because in a lot of ways I think that he is going to have the same role, you know, not necessarily that he's going to be the guy in charge or because of that he's going to have more influence over the director instead of the other way around, but because, I mean, for one thing, Goldsman now I think just has more influence in general because he's not someone who's, you know, written two movies or whatever who the studio is going to hire to craft, you know, the piece of, you know, commercial, you know, consumer
flotsam. Let's just call it flotsam.
Okay, fine. That they want, you know, now he's a guy who's like, look, this isn't my first rodeo. You know, I've been doing this for a few years, and I've made a few billion dollars for the studios, and you know, maybe you should listen to what I have to say. But I mean, like, if you look at his role on Fringe, which is the TV show that he worked on, okay, which was, you know, Kurtzman and Orci and Abrams and all those people, Fringe, he was a consulting producer. But you look at that, and you see the episodes that he wrote. He wrote or had a hand in writing 19 episodes, and almost all of them are like season finales, season premieres, like the big episodes, you know, and he wrote, he directed a number of episodes of Fringe as well.
But some of them very, very well, actually, because I remember the first time I noticed his name because I did watch the first three seasons of Fringe. I remember noticing his name one time because it had a directed by credit and saying to my wife, who was watching the show with me, "Oh no, oh no." And she says, "What?" You know, and I'm like, "Ah, oh, this guy," you know, and, you know, the whole litany of Batman and Robin and all of that stuff. And I remember watching the episode. I don't remember which one it was, but there were some significant moments where, like, the framing, the shot composition was great. And I remember it blowing my mind because I had such a low opinion of him because of the movies that I had disliked that he had written, that it blew my mind that he had, you know, what I saw to be some real serious behind the camera talent.
Yeah. I mean, he directed four episodes of Fringe, including the season premiere and the two-part season finale for season two, which he also wrote. I mean, that's pretty substantial. I mean, that's pretty awesome. I mean, I've only seen the first season, but, you know, it ends with that reveal of Leonard Nimoy, and it's right. Like that he wrote that, you know, or was one of the writers on it, at least. So, I mean, I think that's really interesting. Because I really do see from what, you know, the reports are coming out of, you know, the Hollywood Reporter and stuff like that, or Variety or whoever it is, and what they're saying Goldman's role is going to be on this show, it feels very similar to what his role was on Fringe. And the even more interesting part about that, and maybe the reason why it is happening, is because Kurtzman's role is essentially the same on those two shows. Kurtzman was co-creator.
That's a good point. Yeah.
He wrote the pilot, and then he pretty much left, and he knows that Goldsman can, you know, keep things on track, even though Goldsman's not the showrunner on either of these.
I had completely forgotten about that connection. It makes complete sense for him to come in now because, you know, Kurtzman says to Fuller, "You're going to do stuff." They have the schedule conflict. Fuller says, I got to go take care of these other things. Who else can we bring on?" It totally makes sense that Kurtzman would say, "I got a guy," and they would reach out to him. That, you know what, that actually, that little bit should actually, for anybody who was having, you know, qualms about Goldsman coming in or anything like that, that's actually really good. This is somebody that they can bring on because Kurtzman knows he can trust him, that he's going to deliver something that is worthwhile.
Yeah. You know, and it is one of those things where if you ask anybody, if you talk to anyone, you know, whatever, when the news broke, you know, Akiva Goldsman's going to be working on the show, like, he's become like this punching bag in the fan community.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that a lot of that is really kind of undeserved. People, I mean, nerds hold a grudge, you know? They'll hold that grudge for a good 20 years, you know?
Oh, will they ever?
I mean, we've already had, you know, two Batman since the ones that he wrote for, and, you know, no one, you know, cares about those movies. But I mean, you look at like everything else that he's done, and it's substantial work. Like we were saying, he won a freaking Oscar, you know, but he's also written some good movies like Cinderella Man.
Yeah.
And yeah. I Am Legend, which we talked about on Commentary Trek Stars. I think I love that movie, and I think the script for that is really, really solid. He wrote
until the ending, but that's apparently studio meddling again.
And it's been fixed. That's not the real ending. The real ending is on the Blu-ray. Anyone going to watch it now, select alternate ending, and you're good to go.
But then it's not the real ending. It's the alternate ending.
The alternate ending is the real ending.
Okay, fair. All right. You know what? Yes, you're right, because the alternate ending is so much better than the theatrical one.
Yeah. He wrote The Da Vinci Code and Angels and Demons. You know, I like The Da Vinci Code. I liked Angels and Demons a lot.
I disliked both books so much that there was no way you were getting me in. I read The Da Vinci Code and disliked it greatly, and then somebody said, oh, well, you got to read Angels and Demons, and I read that, and I liked it even less. So I never bothered seeing the movies.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say rush out and see them, but they're okay.
Obviously, Ron Howard likes them. Because yeah. How many movies has Ron Howard worked on with Goldsman now?
Four, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, you win an Oscar for Ron Howard, you get to work with him.
Yeah, he treats you right.
But, you know, he's done a lot of stuff. He's actually done some stuff with some fringe writers recently, like that movie The Fifth Wave. And he wrote Insurgent, and he's got a couple movies coming out. Rings, which is the sequel / reboot to The Ring, right? The horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also writing The Dark Tower.
That's going to be interesting because that's another adaptation with a severely, severely dedicated fan base. That it's going to be really interesting to see how well they play with whatever happens on screen.
Yeah, and they're doing some weird stuff with the storytelling in that one. There's going to be like a companion television show and everything. I don't know. It's
connected universes have gotten out of hand, man. That's all I'm going to say.
Hey, it could be interesting. But speaking of connected universes, I mean, that's one of the things that he's working on now is he's, I guess, running the writer's room for the Transformers cinematic universe.
Yeah.
So that's cool.
Hey, you know what? I'm excited that he's working on Mobile Armored Strike Command, MASC, which was an overlooked gem of a toy line back from the late 80s.
Yeah, I loved that toy line when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And you know, he's done a lot of stuff as a producer as well, producing some very good movies like Mr. and Mrs. Smith, which I love passionately. And Constantine, which if you watch, I got to bring it up. If you watch Steven Soderbergh's Unscripted show, there's a thing where like one of the characters, because it's about like three aspiring actors, and one of them gets a job as a featured extra on Constantine. And so you can watch Unscripted and see her filming the scene. And then you go see Constantine, and you can see her slightly out of focus walk past, you know, Keanu Reeves. But
oh, that's kind of neat.
In the show, Akiva Goldsman is actually, like, talking to her for, like, a good long time about, like, oh, we're going to put you here and blah, blah, blah. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. He worked on that Constantine, which is a very underrated movie. And he also worked on Doug Liman's Fair Game, which is a really, really good movie. So
I haven't seen that.
It's a good, you know, like political thriller, you know.
Okay.
I don't think it was nominated for Best Picture, but it came close. It was like one of those, you know. But yeah, really solid. Good performances by Naomi Watts and Sean Penn, and it's good, a good movie. So yeah, he's done a lot of stuff.
It's time to let go of the Batman and Robin thing, I think, is probably the moral of the story. He's good, he's talented, he's built a career, and he wouldn't keep getting work if he didn't know what he was doing. So
how many things does he have to do that you like in order to erase the one movie that you saw one time 20 years ago, you know?
I saw it more than once.
Well, that's your fault, okay? You have no one to blame but yourself for that one.
I saw it. Well, I mean, you know, we all have movies that we turn to when we want to just vent. So.
apparently. And for the record, I love Batman Forever with all my heart. It holds a very special place.
I do not.
That's fine. You know, it was my first Batman movie. It was great. You know, everyone made fun of me back then when I was 15 years old for liking it. And, you know, people make fun of me now for liking it. But screw that. Batman Forever is amazing.
It's your Star Trek 5.
It is my Star Trek 5.
It's your Star Trek 5. There you go.
It is definitely my Star Trek 5. Yeah.
Cool, man.
All right. So, yeah, you know, stop panicking, people. It's all good. You know?
Yeah.
Brian Fuller still involved. Gretchen Berg and Aaron Harberts, you know, very talented writers and producers. Akiva Goldsman. Can't wait to see what he brings to it, honestly, because it seems pretty obvious that he is a Star Trek fan, having made cameos in not one but two Star Trek movies.
That's true.
Two different characters. He played a Vulcan on the Council Star Trek 09, and then he played an Admiral on the Council in Star Trek Into Darkness. So yeah, exciting times. And it means that we get to do an episode on Batman Forever.
Oh my goodness. The things I do for you, the audience.
Commentary.
Oh, no. Fine. I'll commit to it.
Excellent. You can't take it back. We've got it out of
wax. It's recorded.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's been fun talking about Gretchen Berg and Aaron Harberts and Akiva Goldsman today, but that's not all we're talking about on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm. To the journey!
Some races are like Talaxians. We really don't know how long they've around.
Char, what? I just had a great idea. I need to calm myself down. I need some
Breathe.
Ice. I need
Breathe.
Some ice.
Okay. Okay. Rest your head.
Okay.
Easy. In
All right.
And out.
Warp 5.
What's your favorite episode of Enterprise?
I usually say Strange New World. The first part of Strange New World just reminds me so much of being a kid and growing up in southeastern Oklahoma in the mountains and the woods. And I just imagine what it would be like to go camping on an alien planet.
Meta Treks.
After 150 years of sitting around in the mud, that's got to be one relaxed symbiont.
But there again, it shows that, at least for the symbiont on Trill, that there's life beyond the mud.
Life beyond the mud.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and discover what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts, whether it's iTunes or SoundCloud or Stitcher or TuneIn or our website. You know, we'll be there. And if you do go to iTunes, leave us a review. I can see how many people listen to this show, and I can see how many people leave reviews. Come on, guys. Just please, just like one little thing, just be like,
just dart on in.
Go show us
some love, man. Come on.
Just a little bit. We love that stuff, you know? We also would like to thank our associate producers, Jeff Sutter, Chris Steftenagel, and Norman C. Lau, for your support. Yeah, we couldn't do it without you. And if you want to be like Chris, Norm, and Jeff, head on over to patreon.com/trekfm, where you can become a patron of the network. Over there, you'll find our different goals and milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. So head on over to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And we thank you very much for the support. If you want to contact us, you can find the network on Twitter at TrekFM, or you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Facebook is also where you'll find our listener forum, The Babel Conference. Just type The Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and we'll come right up. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Look for Kessel Junkie. He's out there roaming the social networks. You can also find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig, and co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations with Trek FM's own Matthew Rushing. And Mike, where can people go beyond my information and discover you out on the internet?
Right here on Trek FM, doing From There to Here, which is our daily rewatch show where we look at all 729 episodes of Star Trek. And you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. All right. Well, that's it for this week. Breaking news. I love breaking news. It's always so exciting.
It is.
Next week, we're going to be talking about another disco writer, Kemp Powers, and his new play. I guess you could say it's new. New to London.
New to us.
New to us. One Night in Miami. Thank you.